Chapter 18. They talked for hours. They talked about growing up. It turned out that Kronig also grew up in the Deads, outside of the influence of the industrial sectors, in abject poverty. He had a similar upbringing, fleeting images of parental figures, and lasting impressions of a small group of tight-knit friends, getting into trouble, and doing what they could to get by. Kinney was surprised, then thought himself stupid to have never connected the dots before. It was strange. If he and the sergeant weren't separated by a couple of generations, they probably would have been friends. They talked about conscription into the army, finding the regime distasteful, full of ideas and hope for the future. The pride of being selected for mongoose training. The soul-crushing reality of routine operations. After a time, Kinney began to wonder how many others in the base, whom he'd just seen as faceless oppressors, were actually individuals with their own stories, and not just mindless slaves to the machine. The hierarchy had all just been faces to him, permanently grim, yet interchangeable fixtures that symbolized the oppressive regime of the leader. Because Kinney refused to call the dead bastard great anymore. He'd never get to know those stories. Those people were all dead. Later, Kronig told him about D-99. The peculiar machine was one of the last of its kind, a true battle machine that came down with the colony ships, not retrofitted from an industrial lifting vehicle. Kinney ran his hand over the pitted armour in the dark, thinking of how many soldiers had driven it over the years, and wondered if their neural links had left any residue of their being behind. The Texan mechanics always said that every mongoose had its own personality. Kinney's own M841 was a malicious beast that he never trusted, despite telling himself that it was just a mechanical suit. Running a gloved palm over the old and battered plate of D-99, really looking at it for the first time, he realized that it was as important as the monuments that Kronig coveted so dearly, if not more so. He told the sergeant this, to which the older man responded, "You can have it. It's just a weapon." Kinney squinted, trying to make out the older man's face in the receding beam of light that seeped through the door, searching for any sign of mockery. "I'm serious," he continued, when Kinney hadn't replied. "I can't go back. And someone needs to take D-99 back into service." Kinney shook his head slightly. "I don't understand what you mean." "Defying orders," Kronig explained. "Deserting my post. I've done it before, during the Troubles." He shifted position, then got up to stretch his legs. "So you see, whoever wins this war, I lose. Corvids win, I'm a war criminal. Loyalists win, I'm a deserter. I'll be executed. I can't go back."
"But I deserted with you."
Kronig shrugged again. "You were just following your sergeant, backing up a superior. You had no idea what I was doing in the moment. The worst you'll get is a reprimand. Not me. I have a history of pulling this shit." Kinney rubbed his head, then it dawned on him. "That's why you're still a sergeant, isn't it?" He could just make out Kronig nodding his head in the gloom. "You gonna tell me the story then, sergeant?" Kronig let out a huff, then sat back down.
"Okay. But I'm only telling you because I firmly believe we're going to die soon, all right?"
Kinney laughed, then later wondered if he was actually joking or not.
"It was near the end of the Troubles. We were making good progress against the Loyalist units, mostly made up of crusty old guys with a lifetime of traditions and no actual experience, versus us young lunatics and our wild ideas of independence. They never stood a chance, really. And it was just a matter of time before we drove them from the city, or wiped the bastards out. But going back a bit, before I joined the army, I had a girlfriend back in the Deads."
Even now, after their frankly disturbing bonding conversations, Kinney still had difficulty imagining the sergeant being kind to another human being.
"She left me when I got conscripted. Can't blame her, really. But she broke my heart. And I never lost feelings for Emma. We remained in contact via the message system over the years, as friends."
He stopped and breathed hard, and it occurred to Kinney that the old soldier had probably never told this story to anybody before.
"Eventually she got engaged to a factory worker, and she moved to an industrial sector just before the Troubles broke out. Initially, it was okay. The fighting didn't really touch where she lived, but as the war dragged on, we shepherded the enemy forces closer and closer to the outer sectors, intending to drive them out entirely. Kinney already felt like he knew how this story would end, but he just nodded his head occasionally and continued to listen. We were about to launch a major offensive, designed to shatter the cohesion of the Loyalist units in a final push, then split off and mop up the remains and secure victory. Our axis of advance took us through the sector directly next to the one Emma lived in. But I couldn't warn her, because the message system was disabled to enforce operational security. He stopped and swallowed hard. Evidently, this was bringing things to the surface that he had not confronted in a long time. The heavies went in first. They took the first line of resistance and utterly smashed the Loyalists. My MOG unit was to echelon through them and continue the advance, but this was where we learned that the remnants of an enemy Mongoose regiment had scattered into the adjacent sector. Where Emma lived, Kinney said quietly. Where Emma lived, Crony confirmed gravely. I ran. I took D-99 and made a beeline for Emma's habitation stack, and found the rogue unit wrecking the whole place, scorching the earth as they went. Kronig went very silent, and Kinney shifted uncomfortably, unsure of what to say. You couldn't save her. He spoke the words softly, not wanting to upset the sergeant, but wanting to know her fate regardless. Oh no, I saved her all right, he replied. It was just how I saved her that did the damage. Kinney had seen the sergeant fight enough to know what he meant, but he explained anyway. I get angry sometimes, and that was definitely one of those times. I ripped them apart. I smashed their chassis, tore drivers from their harnesses, sawed their heads off, crushed torsos, burned flesh. I wanted to drown the city in their blood that day, and Emma saw all of it. After it was over, I popped my canopy. I wanted to tell her I'd come to save her, but the look she gave me was pure terror. Kronig went still as a statue, before letting out a breath he'd been holding. She didn't even recognize me. I tried to explain, but her fiancé started screaming at me. So I just dropped canopy and left. Most of my squad died in that assault, and I wasn't there with them. Understandably, the army viewed their deaths as my fault. I don't feel guilt, and I don't regret my choice. I willingly traded their lives for hers, and she broke my heart again. Kinney absorbed it all, tried to imagine what it must have looked like, the donkey, that awful claw and saw blade, and what they can do to a man. What happened when you turned yourself in? Kinney asked, though it didn't really matter, as the result was this damaged old relic sat in front of him. The war ended shortly after that assault. The army needed jack-compatible drivers and couldn't afford to execute me. Instead, I was given a lifetime promotion ban and a social downgrade to zero asset status. Kinney had heard of the term when growing up. Being reduced to a zero asset was effectively the civilian equivalent of execution, as it made it illegal for prospective employers to actually give you work. You were given a life sentence of service. Kronig nodded awkwardly at this, as though he had never thought of it in those terms. So you see, I deserved everything I got, and if I go back, I'm dead. He patted the thigh of D-99 with his metal hand, and it clanged dully. That's why you get to return this. The old beast is army property. Kinney laughed. There probably wouldn't be an army left after another couple of days of this chaos. Whatever came next, whether it was the corporation or a new local government, whoever piloted D-99 in the future would not be a soldier of the MPA. What's he going to do instead? Kinney inquired, wasting no time in climbing up into the confines of his new war machine, as Kronig did a chamber check of his carbine and rolled his shoulders. Well, Reynolf, the former sergeant said, a new levity to his growling voice that Kinney had never heard before. I think I'm going to walk up that hill and kill every fucking thing I find. Kinney nodded and pulled his canopy into place with a clack of metal. Kronig wanted to continue speaking. He was about to tell Kinney that he was proud of his young charge,
for not once mentioning the space's offer of a flight off-world. Regardless of whatever side he fell on, the private was invested in his world and would not abandon it, wouldn't take the easy way out. He was about to put all of this into words when Kinney's voice grated from D-99's external speaker. "Sergeant," he said with an exaggerated point of a gauntlet. "He's awake." Kronig looked to the wall where the intruder sat. This physical embodiment of an invasion from a hostile, almost alien force sat up and regarded him with those cruel blue eyes.
"Are you happy now that's out of your system?"
he sneered in his unusual accent.
"Are you primitives ready to make a deal now?"
Kronig moved. The wall exploded. 50 feet of the damn thing, a mixture of concrete, rebar and glass. It was like the habitation block itself had grown sick of Arm Brewster's nonsense and decided to punch him. To Mirante, it looked like a giant claymore going off, the huge directional blast completely engulfing the scout leg unit in tons of masonry and broken furniture, rendered unrecognizable as it mixed in with a grey mess that poured over the traitor, and she just stared in disbelief. The triplet scrambled backwards and narrowly avoided being swept away by the deluge as a wave of dust rolled over him, obscuring the Mog from view. Mirante just stared at the mess as the dust began to settle, open-mouthed, as the triplet ran out of the cloud and promptly collided with her. Metal clashed, and Mirante was nearly tipped off of her feet. She grasped the hysterical young man and yelled into his face, urging that he calm down. The private did so, and the powerful corporal released his chassis and pushed him away with armored gauntlets as she watched what emerged from the settling debris. There, covered from top to bottom in a thick layer of grey powder, shedding rubble with every movement like a snake shed scales, was Eddie. The heavy mech had run through the habitation block. It was brute genius, Mirante realized. Practically the only way to sneak up on the hunter without his sensor equipment picking up the Toro's considerable mass. Then she realized that Blake had used them as bait. She stood now, all 40 feet of her looming chassis tilted down, to observe the pitiful vision of the traitor's mech, half buried in concrete, skinny legs askew, mangled and pointing to the sky. Eddie's long cannon's barrel angled down until it was no more than an inch away from Arm Brewster's glacis. Her autoloader clunked loudly as the smaller leg's hard shield flickered out of existence, and the traitor's buckled railgun tried to traverse into a position where he could engage the new threat. Blake broadcast one word over her external speakers, somehow carrying the rage of an entire unit betrayed and murdered by one of their own.
"Die!"
She fired. The muzzle flash obscured the mech completely and kicked all powder from Eddie's frame in one almighty thump, deafening report cutting out Mirante's audio as the concussion shook her guts even inside her suit. The armor-piercing, fin-stabilized, self-discarding sabot did not even have time to discard its slug casing before it punched through Arm Brewster's darkened sanctuary, pulping his torso and pushing it straight through the rear armor of his dead machine before embedding his mushed carcass a dozen feet into the ground. When her hearing came back online, Mirante realized that Blake was speaking. Her voice came out slowly, deliberately pronouncing every syllable so as to not make any mistakes.
"Corporal Mirante. Corporal Mirante. I'm sorry. Corporal Mirante. Yeah, boss. I'm here."
There was a long pause before the captain switched from her external speaker to radio. The transmission seemed to be suffering from interference, as though that damn off-world jamming had started up again.
I think I'm dying, Corporal. You should see the blood in here. It's everywhere. I must have lost nearly all of it. Anna. I'm sorry."
"Shut up, boss. You're not going anywhere. We still need to get you to Central Command." Blake did not answer. Mirante took a deep breath, made a conscious effort to stand up straight as she could, and turned to her last remaining trooper. If the boss died now, She would either tip over again or just stand still. Either way, Mirante did not relish the prospect of popping her canopy to go and retrieve the black box from her command pit. She had to take action, right now, before the moment passed. "Private, I'll take the lead. Cover our rear, and we'll escort the captain to the objective. Confirm." "Roger that, Corporal," the triplet said without complaint. She felt guilty that she couldn't tell which one he was. "You with me, boss?"
"I think so, Corporal. We need to get to Central."
"I know," Mirante replied, striding past the heavy mech with a glance at her compass. "Just follow me. We'll be fine, Edwina." And with no ammo, no shields, and no real clue where she was, Anna Mirante led the survivors of Sector 78 towards their final goal.
"Thank you for the offer of a ransom, but on behalf of Great Leader and all his armed forces, Saint rest his soul, we must respectfully decline."
Kronig said the words with such force, such finality, that the spacer's eyes met his and grew wide. He had just enough time to realize what was about to happen, and his scrawny arms, one broken and flopping uselessly, rose to protect his face as fate caught up to him. Kronig's black prosthetic shot out like lightning, crushing the off-worlder's skull against the unyielding stone of the crypt with a sharp crack of impact, ending him in an instant. "It did indeed look like a lizard's egg being squished," Kinney observed silently. Without pausing to even clean the gore from his fist, Kronig pushed the door of the crypt open slowly with the muzzle of his carbine. He smoothly checked his arcs, weapon tucked in tight, body and head moving as a single unit, both eyes open, just above the weapon sights as he scanned for threats. He cleared the doorway quickly, and Kinney stomped out after him, checking himself so he didn't accidentally break into a run. D-99 was a different beast to the cantankerous old M841. The private felt no resistance through the jack, no tingling of the fingers or ghosts on the display screen. He simply thought, and it reacted. He understood now how Kronig had operated all those years without an assault harness securing him in place as the large power suit rotated on the spot, panning about with guns up. It didn't fight him, this machine, like it knew on some level that it was designed for warfare, and was totally comfortable with the fact. He had to suppress a childish grin. This was what he always imagined it to feel like piloting a MOG, not that travesty of cobbled-together crap the army issued out, but this smoothly operating killer. It would make a fine addition to the Corvid arsenal. Fingers hovered over triggers as Kinney swept gun barrels across the terrain, noting in the failing light that all was still. Smoke spewed from countless wreckages of vehicles upslope, mingled with thousands of dead, bodies butchered and burst by guns meant for taking on armoured vehicles. In the failing light, Kinney noted how the spacer casualties were few and far between. There was the odd agrav, and a strange assortment of robotic-looking infantry units that were definitely not local, spread about among the dead. He was glad of his filters, and wondered how Kronig was dealing with the inevitable horrific smells. Mixed odours of ozone, burnt cordite, and flesh laid open by high-powered weaponry. He knew that corpses voided their bowels shortly after death, and never wished to experience that particular smell again. Kronig probably didn't even notice. "It looks clear," the former sergeant sub-vocalized, and Kinney's systems picked up the sound, automatically amplifying it perfectly. He increased audio gain as he replied, straining his ears for something, anything that might warn of any enemy out there. It did not seem likely that the two forces had wiped each other out. "There's no rumbling," Kinney said over speakers as quietly as he could.
"Maybe the floating fortress has been taken out," Kronig replied, his customary growl in place. "I intend to find out."
Kinney shook his head inside the power suit. The old geezer was truly insane. "Are you really going to go up there?" Kronig turned to face him, and a smirk crept onto his face.
"Of course. What, you think because we had a nice chat that I can undo 30 years of experience? You separatists are vermin, and I'll kill every one of you if I can."
Kinney took a tone of mock offence. "Hey, I never said I was going to run off and join them now." Kronig patted Kinney's carapace and turned back up the hill.
No, of course you won't. You have your orders, Private.
And then the man laughed at the absurdity of the situation. Kinney turned to look down the hill, catching the last rays of light as the sun dipped below the horizon. The city sprawled in all directions below them. Lights began to turn on across all the sectors, slowly lighting up Kinney's lifelong home as he watched. He thought that it was beautiful from up here, when all you could see was the orderly spacing of the sectors, neatly arranged and quiet, as though there was no fighting going on down there. No death, no poverty, no hunger or suffering. From up there on the hill, he could see why the original colonists had put such value in the place and claimed it for their own, rather than let the corporations take over. But that was then, he told himself, frowning at his mind's attempt to undermine his beliefs with simple sentimentality. And this is now.
Martim's beard!
Kinney blurted, as synchronized movements suddenly lurched into life across every sector he could see. Every gate, perfectly in time, rose into position without ceremony, isolating every sector from its neighbour, instantly making every Corvid's, every spacer's job considerably harder.
Crony, look at that! They did it!
And he turned to look at his sergeant. But there was nobody there. Kinney took it in. They had succeeded. The Loyalist mission had been successful, and it hadn't depended on him or Kronig to get it done. Their impact could not be quantified, but Kinney did not presume his impact on events had been any more than minimal. He was just a man, and now he was alone, free to pursue whatever goals he wanted. Kinney turned his radio on, gave a token check to any Loyalist units, but that damn interference was back and he got no reply. He decided to leave the thing on. It would give him something to listen to as he went about his work. Now he had nobody else to rely on for the first time in his life. He did not like the silence. I think I'm going to find my brother, Reynolf Kinney said to nobody at all, then started to descend the hill, one well-oiled, mechanical step at a time, as a familiar message began to play.
Welcome, Brigador.
Great leader is dead.
Solo Nobre must fall. Here is your contract.